Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The White House explains reasoning for the Iraqi airstrikes, and Israel and Hamas continue fighting. I'm Marty Johnson, reporting from Washington. President Barack Obama says he decided to intervene in Iraq because the U.S. cannot look away when innocent people are facing a massacre. In his weekly address today, Mr. Obama said food and water, the U.S. military dropped to thousands of Iraqi civilians stranded on a mountain after fleeing insurgents, will help them survive.
We've begun a humanitarian effort to help those Iraqi civilians trapped on that mountain. The terrorists that have taken over parts of Iraq have been especially brutal to religious minorities, rounding up families, executing men, enslaving women, and threatening the systematic destruction of an entire religious community, which would be genocide.
Those refugees include Christians, Yazidis, and other religious minorities who were ordered by Islamic State militants to convert or die. On Friday, the U.S. military launched two rounds of airstrikes against the Islamic State fighters in northwest Iraq using drones and fighter jets. In addition to the refugees, Mr. Obama said the action was meant to help protect American diplomats and military advisors serving in Iraq.
I made it clear that if they attempt to advance further, our military would respond with targeted strikes. That's what we've done. And if necessary, that's what we'll continue to do. We have Americans serving across Iraq, including our embassy in Baghdad, and we will do whatever is needed to protect our people.
Administration officials say the strikes came as the extremists were beginning to threaten the periphery of the Kurdish city of Erbil. Fighting between Israel's military and Hamas continues today along the Gaza Strip. The fighting resumed Friday after a three-day pause in the month-long war, dealing a blow to the Egyptian-led efforts to secure a long-term ceasefire between the two sides. Israel pounded Gaza with airstrikes Friday, shortly after Hamas resumed rocket attacks against Israel. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev says that Hamas fighters have been indiscriminately targeting civilians.
Hamas has indiscriminately targeted men, women, and children. And in so doing, Hamas has not only shown its total disregard for Israeli life, but has shown that it has no qualms whatsoever about once again endangering and bringing tragedy upon the civilian population of Gaza.
64 Israeli soldiers and three civilians have been killed in the fighting. Nearly 1,900 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed. The World Health Organization has declared the Ebola outbreak in West Africa a public health emergency of international concern. A WHO committee is calling for a coordinated international response to stop the disease at its source and prevent it from spreading to other countries. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
After sifting through a mountain of information and evidence over the past 2 days, the WHO Emergency Committee unanimously declared that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa constitutes an extraordinary event which demands extraordinary measures to bring it under control. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, says recommendations issued by the committee aim to contain existing outbreaks in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and to prevent further international spread. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. says a unilateral attempt by Russia to deliver humanitarian aid to eastern Ukraine will be viewed as an invasion. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, told a U.N. Security Council meeting on Friday that while Russia has proposed creating humanitarian corridors to send urgent aid to civilians in eastern Ukraine, such aid should be delivered by international organizations.
And given that Ukraine has allowed international humanitarian groups to deliver aid within its territory, there is no logical reason why Russia should seek to deliver it. Therefore, any further unilateral intervention by Russia into Ukrainian territory, including one under the guise of providing humanitarian aid, would be completely unacceptable and deeply alarming.
There's more on this story on our website at voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Burma, also known as Myanmar, for talks with Southeast Asian foreign ministers about tensions in the South China Seas. Kerry began his day meeting with senior diplomats from members of the Association for Southeast Asian Nations assembled for an annual security conference. And in Japan, tens of thousands of people turned out today to mark the 69th anniversary of the nuclear bombing of the city of Nagasaki, which mostly ended World War II. Thousands of aging survivors, government officials, and delegates from countries, including U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Caroline Kennedy. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Odette Frazier.
Ghana has gone through a cycle of booms and busts. It seems to take a regular four-year cycle. And it's partly due to things that happen externally on the international stage.
Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama talks about his country's economic challenges.
Up to this point, we cannot account for a lot of investment, American investment in Liberia. The oldest investment in Liberia by the Americans is Firestone, the rubber plantation for many, many years.
The Liberian government hopes for more U.S. investments at the conclusion of the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit.
Bahie was last in Guinea in March, visiting family in her northern hometown of Mamou. She says she told everyone to keep their hands and their homes clean and to keep their kids off the streets.
And the World Health Organization calls the Ebola outbreak an international emergency. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ghana has been a showcase for democracy in West Africa for many years. It's also had a generally strong economy, though it has slowed over the past year with a weakening currency and a rise in inflation. The country's president, John Dramani Mahama, was recently in Washington, D.C. for the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. During his visit, he came by our studios where VOA's Vincent Makori asked him about the challenges facing the economy.
Ghana has gone through a cycle of booms and busts. It seems to take a regular four-year cycle. And it's partly due to things that happen externally on the international stage, but also partly due to our own internal stresses. On the external stage, I would attribute it to the fact that our leading exports are international commodities that are subject to fluctuation in their prices. And so for the last challenge that we're currently going through, it is as a result of the dramatic decline in gold and cocoa prices in 2012 and 2013. It led to a loss of export revenues in the magnitude of about $1.5 billion. And so naturally it would affect, you know, our economy. But internally, I would also say that it was a result of some policies that we were implementing. One was a wage policy to try and create a universal wage salary structure for all public sector workers. I think its management went out of hand, and so it ballooned the wage bill from a little under $3 billion to almost $9 billion by 2013. Aside from that, I guess that the subsidies that we had on petroleum products and utilities also contributed. These subsidies were unsustainable, and government has been struggling to take them off over the last several years. So that combination of factors is probably what led to the current crisis we face. And so we need to make some fundamental reforms in the substructure of our economy in order that we don't have this continuous cyclical economic challenges.
Mm-hmm. Now, locally, one of the biggest challenges that Ghana has faced just along with many African countries is adding value to the product from within the country. In fact, having manufacturing kind of vibrant in the country so that you don't have to import things from outside. I mean, yeah. It doesn't make sense for a Ghanaian to buy chocolate from abroad. What are you doing to make sure that the local industry can blossom and serve the country?
In my State of the Nation address this year, I called for a transformation of the economy, and we're working to do that. We have exports bringing in about $13 billion a year, and then we turn around and import about $17 billion worth of products a year. So there's a $4 billion gap in our terms of trade. Now that gap is filled with a lot of things that we could comparatively produce ourselves. We import $400 million worth of rice a year, as are the last statistics we have available. We import almost $200 million worth of sugar a year. We import fish products, in excess of $100 to $200 million a year. We import tomato products. These are items that we have a comparative advantage to produce. I mean, there's no reason why we should be importing rice. There's a time when Ghana was self-sufficient in production of rice, and actually was a net exporter of rice. And so government is doing everything to, apart from increasing our exports, also import substitutes, make sure that we increase the production of some of the products for which we're spending a lot of foreign currency in order that we can bring down our imports figures. Aside from these major imports, we also have items like toothpicks, you know, made of bamboo from China. We have bamboo forests in Ghana, and I mean, the equipment for manufacturing toothpicks costs $50,000. It can be a small family business, and we don't need to import toothpicks. Plastic products, toy dolls, and like you said, chocolates, which we have a comparative advantage to produce. We're one of the leading cocoa manufacturing countries in the world. And so that is the strategy of government. And so that transformation is ongoing, and I believe that it will take time. The results don't show overnight. It takes a little while, and I'm sure that Ghanaians will see the results over time.
That was the president of Ghana, John Dramani Mahama. He spoke with VOA's Vincent Macquarie here in Washington, D.C. Liberia's vice president, Joseph Boakai, says his country would like to see more U.S. investments besides the customary ones of Firestone and Coca-Cola. He says President Obama's Power Africa initiative will benefit Liberia greatly, a country he says suffers from frequent power shortages due to the destruction of its infrastructure during 14 years of civil war. He spoke with VOA's James Butte about Liberia's relationship with the United States, among other things.
As you know, within Africa, Liberia is believed to have the closest connection in terms of friendship with the United States. Up to this point, we cannot account for a lot of investment, American investment in Liberia. You know, the oldest investment in Liberia by the Americans is Firestone, the rubber plantation for many, many years. There are some like Coca-Cola and others, but we would like to see more and more of U.S. investment. And besides Obama's Power for Africa, you know, Liberia, one of the disadvantages we have in terms of competing with our neighbors is the shortage of electricity. So we believe the announcement for $26 billion investment into Africa and for power will be able to turn things around.
Say I am GE, I'm Coca-Cola, and I would like to invest in Liberia. What measures have your government taken or put in place to encourage me to come and invest in Liberia?
We have taken up a lot of reform programs since we came to power. The rule of law, governance, working also with the judiciary, and the U.S. had been partner in that. And we believe that those systems with transparency, accountability, corruption, those are issues that we have to deal with and we've been dealing with to be able to attract American investment.
You mentioned corruption. President Sirleaf herself has admitted that corruption is endemic in the society. Her critics have said, you know, in fact, corruption has become worse during her administration. But you are saying that you're taking steps to fight corruption.
Corruption is not something that this administration started. In fact, the only reason people are getting more and more aware of corruption is because we are against it. There was a time that nobody even talked about corruption. And you know, you're a Liberian, you know what existed in other regimes where almost everything was possible. We have put into place systems that will monitor. And because we're doing that, every time there's a violation, our attentions are drawn to them. So it is not that this government is more corrupt. It's because now that we have drawn a sword against corruption. Our budget, everybody knows what the budget is like. The Extractive Industries Transparency Act, Liberia was awarded because what comes out of iron ore, what comes out of rubber, what comes out of other minerals, and what is paid to government is within the public domain. So all of these are now made possible, something that was never of the past.
That was Liberia's Vice President Joseph Boakai. He spoke with VOA's James Butty at the Liberian Embassy in Washington, D.C. With the World Health Organization now calling the Ebola outbreak an international emergency and new cases moving across borders, the virus is no longer seen as the burden of a distant continent. That message is resonating strongly in France, a major hub for West African air traffic and home to a sizable African diaspora. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
Alpha West fled the dictatorship in his native Guinea a decade ago. Today, the reggae singer and political dissident fears another threat, the Ebola virus now ravaging his homeland and other parts of West Africa. Wes says his brothers, sisters, and parents live in the capital, Conakry. He can't go home because he's a political refugee, but he's anxious about them. Wes isn't the only worried expatriate. At places like Le Fouta Jalon, a Guinean restaurant in central Paris, he and fellow countrymen trade greetings and news about the virus. But Fouta Jalon owner Oumou Bari says Ebola will not stop her visits home. Bari was last in Guinea in March, visiting family in her northern hometown of Mamou. She says she told everyone to keep their hands and their homes clean and to keep their kids off the streets. So far, no Ebola cases have cropped up in France, but the virus has now spread to Nigeria and possibly other countries as well. Spain, along with the United States, have repatriated citizens with Ebola. Still, Dr. François Bricaire, a specialist in infectious diseases at the Pitié-Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, says the risk of a major outbreak in France remains very low.
Mais il faut faire attention.
Bricaire says there's always a chance of a few cases because Ebola's incubation period can last up to 3 weeks. But even if a case is diagnosed, measures will be taken immediately to stop transmission. France is taking no chances. Air France flights from West Africa now screen passengers before departure, and French airports watch out for suspect cases. A number of French hospitals have special isolation rooms for sick patients. But many Africans here are anxious about the spread of the virus back home, including 65-year-old Senegalese Amara Chior, whose country so far has been spared from Ebola. Chior calls home frequently to check up on his family in Dakar. Even though he considers Ebola very dangerous, he still plans to visit them in December. In the suburb of Montreuil, known as Little Bamako because of its large Malian population, community leader Lassana Niakate says many fellow Malians fear another hardship for their conflict-scarred country. Mali borders Guinea, and Niakate says Malians and Guineans cross that frontier every day. So the risk is great, he believes, that Ebola will travel as well. For its part, the Guinean diaspora has organized awareness and fundraising campaigns to send medical supplies to health workers back home. Wes, the reggae singer, has given benefit concerts. Wes says the Guinean community is very close in France. A crisis like Ebola binds it even closer. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The inaugural Washington Fellowship activities for young African leaders ended in Washington, D.C. last week. The YALI initiative was launched in 2010 by U.S. President Barack Obama to support an emerging generation of African leaders as they work to drive economic growth, enhance democratic governance, and strengthen the civil society structures that would help the continent grow and prosper. Dr. Mesfin Bezune is a director in the School of Business at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia. He sponsored 25 of this year's fellows. I reached him in Atlanta and asked him for his assessment of the just concluded YALI activities.
500 competitively selected potential leaders from 49 African countries. They were here for 6 weeks, and they were hosted by 20 U.S. universities. And each of the universities had the opportunity to host 25 fellows, of which 50% of them were female. Last week, we spent it meeting with President Obama, the First Lady, and congressional leaders, and others from the administration that the fellows had the opportunity to meet and interact.
So what prompted you to sponsor 25 of the yearly fellows this year?
The call for proposal came out, and that was distributed throughout the U.S. And Clark Atlanta University, we felt we had the capabilities and the interest to host these fellows in business entrepreneurship.
What were your assessments of the 25 participants or fellows that you sponsored?
These were just the most outstanding individuals I have had to interact in my entire academic life. I've been teaching over 25 years. I have never seen such a group in one place, talented, and know what exactly what they wanted to do. And truly, they were the cream of the cream. We were very happy here at Clark Atlanta University, and I'm sure all the other institutions share this view.
In what way do you think that the Young African Leaders Initiative benefited their participants?
First of all, these young African leaders who are here have already established a record of accomplishment in innovation, in community service, and leadership in their organizations, in their communities, in their countries. So they were not just anybody. So once they got here, I think what we were able to provide them was a sense of confidence and competencies in some of these areas I just discussed. In our case, was business entrepreneurship. So we were able to expose them to a variety of tools and leadership skills. So we believe we have really enhanced their knowledge. I believe they benefited a great deal, and the same here. We benefited a great deal from them. So it's a win-win situation for everyone that participated in this program.
What do you hope to see happen with the participants you sponsored upon returning to their respective countries and their respective walks of life?
Well, there is a number of programs that was actually specified during our last week in Washington, D.C., by the President, by the Secretary of State, that the missions, the USAID missions, in collaboration with the embassies in their own respective countries, have numerous jumpstart activities that is waiting for them, actually, once they get back. That is one area. The other area, imagine having these 500 well-accomplished already young people, bring them together for 6 weeks and 1 week in Washington. The networking that they have already established among themselves will have tremendous positive impact in their life looking forward.
Do you plan on following up with some of these participants or all of them that you sponsored?
Absolutely. Today, for example, that's all I have done all day was corresponding with them, writing some recommendation for them already. And we are planning and following through, and hopefully even we might collaborate in some projects with some fellows in some countries. So the impact will be really felt in years to come.
Dr. Mesfin Bezune is the director of Summer Institute, Washington Fellows at the School of Business in Clark Atlanta University. He spoke with me from Atlanta, Georgia. The Islamist militant group Boko Haram is described as one of the most deadly terrorist organizations in Africa. Based in northeastern Nigeria, the group has waged a relentless campaign of terror against the Nigerian government and its citizens as it seeks to establish an Islamic State. In this VOA special report, an alleged cell phone video from a Nigerian soldier showed the extrajudicial execution of suspected members of the terrorist group Boko Haram. Nigeria's military says those allegations are false. VOA's State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports on an investigation into the fight against Boko Haram.
The video shot in May shows people in uniform slitting the throats of men lying before a shallow grave. It was given to VOA by a lance corporal in Nigeria's 7th Division. VOA was unable to independently confirm the authenticity of the video, but was able to analyze its digital fingerprints, as well as the dialect of the soldiers, their mannerisms, equipment, and the surrounding environment. The video was also viewed by one outside expert who said it appeared authentic. Amnesty International also published parts of a video that appears to have been shot during the same incident with different camera angles. Nigerian government spokesman Mike Omeri told VOA that Nigerian soldiers will not degenerate to that level, and he suggested the video was made elsewhere in West Africa. Ibrahim Ahmed of VOA's House of Service spent nearly a month in northern Nigeria reporting this story. He says the soldier who gave him the video described those executed as Boko Haram suspects captured in Nigeria's Sambisa forest.
Some of them who get arrested, they have a particular way of dealing with them. He didn't go into specifics of how they deal with them, but he showed me the video of how they deal with them.
Adam Arley is a Washington lobbyist for Nigeria's government. He says officials are looking into what the video shows.
First of all, they said we've got to investigate. Second of all, they said it's, you know, we have laws that our troops and our people are supposed to and expected to uphold. And if they don't uphold them, we'll take appropriate action.
Arley says Nigeria is trying to fight what he calls a ruthless enemy in a measured fashion consistent with international norms.
Who did what? Don't know. They're trying to find out. But I think the important thing is that the government says we don't condone this. We don't. They're not acting on orders.
Nigerian troops have faced years of human rights complaints, often holding local communities responsible for rebel actions, says Human Rights Watch's Sarah Margon.
There has never been, as far as we can tell, any real accountability for the security force abuses that have happened, not just vis-a-vis Boko Haram in the north, but throughout the country.
She says that leaves many Nigerian civilians with nowhere to turn.
They absolutely don't support, for the most part, the tactics and even ideology of Boko Haram, but they don't feel comfortable talking to the government authorities either, because so many young men have been swept up, brought and held incommunicado elsewhere in the country. So many young men have been killed simply because they're in the north.
The suffering of the Boko Haram conflict is more widely felt than the Biafra civil war, says Nigerian Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka.
There were atrocities which were committed, but you never had such irregular, getting to be near predictable level of carnage. I think this is what is horrifying. There's no war zone, there's no battle line, it's everywhere.
VOA's Ibrahim Ahmed says Nigerians are living in fear.
You don't know what is going to happen to you from day to day. I spoke with a teacher in Bama, and what he told me was that every single time they're going into Maiduguri, the state capital of Borno, they have to say goodbye to their family because they don't know whether they're coming back or not.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says he's working to bring back more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram, and says he's moving to improve some of the poor living conditions in the north underlying this conflict.
There does seem to be a willingness by the Nigerian authorities to start moving in the right direction. In the case of Boko Haram, it's not going to be just a military solution that deals with that problem. There's a long history of grievances and disenfranchisement and marginalization up in the north.
Arley says Nigeria recognizes it must do more than just throw the army at the problem.
They've got to have economic assistance, political reform, strengthen local institutions, give the people of the Northeast state a reason to support the government and a reason to fight against the insurgents.
As for Boko Haram, the group's leader, Abubakar Shekau, mocks an international campaign to rescue the abducted girls and calls on Nigeria's government to set free Boko Haram fighters. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll review and discuss the historic U.S. African Leaders Summit with two of its key players, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the top U.S. Africa diplomat, and Florizel Lizier, the assistant U.S. trade representative for Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Still to come in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. It's now time for a Saturday Music Spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
My sweetie, sweetie, my baby, baby. Hola, bika kwensonga, luachina ngena tonde. Chiulina munda, luakubolu mumegu. My sweetie, sweetie, my baby, baby.
nimekuleta kwangu nyumbani. Karibuni kupekiti, unieleze nini mama. Jamila lipo kakaanza kulia, oh na kushinda kuongea. Hata mimi mwenyewe nikaumia, kujiuliza kwa nini analia.
Analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa. Jamila analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa.
Jamila alipoanza kuongea, aliongea na maumivu mingi. Na bila alikuwa naongea, nikamuonea huruma. Ati walianza besi bora, siku nyingine arudi nyumbani. Kumuuliza kama amepata mwingine, akamfungia virago.
Jamila analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa. Jamila analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa.
Sijui nitamsaidiaje. Jamila nimwambia afanyeje. Nitamupa kitanda cha kulala kule, lakini mambo ya mapenzi naogopa. Zamani mimi na yeye tulishindana, kapata muke, akapata bwana. Sasa analia kamilio nifanyeje. Jamila analia, nimwambia fanyaje.
Yeah. Jamila analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa. Jamila analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa. Jamila analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa. Jamila analia, wana wake amemwacha. Jamila analia, wana wake amemtupa.
Muda mrefu Jamila tuonani, mezi gani mekuleta kwangu nyumbani. Karibu nikupe kiti, unieleze nini mama. Jamila lipo kakaanza kulia, oh na kushinda kuongea. Hata mimi mwenyewe nikaumia, kujiuliza kwa nini analia.
L'argent appelle l'argent.
gratis, t'as fait son ami riche. Le riche ne prête son argent, sa villa et sa voiture. T'as celui qui est riche comme un bruit.
C'est comme ça. asumuria sotu ya mokinze ya motomoko masoba mpangeza mabongo ya kazambi
zambini
haza ilunga Asumunya sautu ya mukinze na mutomoko Masoba mpangeza na mabogwe tanzami
Zambini
aza ilunga Yotata ya weye, yodiole pere Zambi ya bolingu, eske biso batu ukela na ilina yo Ukela kibiso koto mula seko pasi
And that was music from the continent. Now, the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Here's Dr. Yang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to look at America's relations with Africa. And then simultaneously, I want to look at African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, the pressing issue is the summit. We talk about the conception of the summit, how we thought about it, how the president came with the idea, and what the White House Committee on the Summit produced, and what the State Department, the Commerce Department, and other agencies did in preparation for the summit. So conceptually speaking, the organizers of the summit have demonstrated beyond reasonable doubt, now that the summit is here, that the African leaders were consulted, and the African Union is here, the head of the African Union is here, and they are trying to bring to the attention of the American people what they think Africa needs and what must be done with Africa. This was the conception, the White House idea, which can now be seen as part of the building blocks for the Obama legacy, going alongside Bill Clinton and President George Bush Jr. Now, when we look at actuality of the summit, you're going to have historians looking back and giving their point of view that there is the comparative narrative waiting for attention, that the summit today will be compared to summit with China, with Brazil, with Turkey, with India, and with Japan. So scholars who are going to write about international relations of Africa are going to see the summit as one building block in this edifice of African summits. So when you talk about actuality, you talk about the actuality, the idealization, and the solidification of the summit. So the summit is here. So when you talk about actuality, the comparative side is one. But then from an historical side, one could also remember what happened in the United States. Obama is the 44th president of the United States, and George Washington was the first president of the United States. The legacy of George Washington was the preservation of a Republican government. Then you have to see how George Washington relates to Obama with regard to legacy. The legacy of George Washington was the establishment of a Republican government in a world of kings. And today, when we look at the summit, we see that this is a very revolutionary, very interesting development in American history. Never has ever been an American president challenged to host a summit with the leaders of Africa. George Washington didn't have to deal with the African summit. Lincoln didn't deal with one. Even John Kennedy didn't have to do with one. He had the Alliance for Progress with the Latin Americans. But for Africa, the only thing he could do for them was to have the Peace Corps volunteers. That's a big legacy of the Kennedy administration. So when we look at the summit and we try to locate the summit in the American diplomatic edifice, we can see the legacy of Bill Clinton and AGOA. AGOA is a struggling baby waiting for blood transfusion from the Republicans and the Democrats at this moment. So those who are concerned about AGOA, even though it's not a complete fit, they would like to see AGOA resurrected or revived or strengthened. So when we talk about actuality of the summit, AGOA becomes very important. So when we talk about the consequences of the summit, the immediate legacies of President Obama come to mind. Number one, Power Africa. President Obama is interested in industrialization of Africa. That is not going to happen unless the Africans are able to industrialize their society. If they industrialize their society and they build on this Obama Power Africa, they will be on the right path towards development. Related to this is there must be serious African-American scientific studies on the geological resources in Africa. So if you are talking about Power Africa, you do not only talk about solar energy, thermal energy, hydro energy, and other forms of energy, like coal and other things. So this is where the African leaders must have a new narrative, new relationship with America. Not a summit of heads of states, but a summit of scientists from across Africa and businessmen and technologists who can come together to make sure that African-American relations are meaningful, effective, and productive. This leads you to the consequences of the summit. If the summit is going to be meaningful for the Africans have to make sure this is not the only summit. There will be many summits to come from this time on. So subsequent American presidents will have their own summit. It will be institutionalized. And then the Africans would make sure that they go to Africa, use Addis Ababa as their UN, so that African leaders will welcome leaders from the big powers annually, so that the leaders from the United States and Japan or anywhere else can go to Addis Ababa and have a meeting. And this way they don't have to pick and choose which African leaders should come to visit their country. The Africans will be doing the hosting. They know their own problem. If there are political lepers in Africa who must be quarantined, they need to be done by Africans, but not by foreigners. And that is the message Africans should take away from this summit. The summit should be institutionalized. The summit should be the beginning of the greater things to come. For Americans, they have to make sure that the Chinese, the big nations, the Turks, and the Latin Americans are not going to outmaneuver them when it comes to Africa policy. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Niang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Odette Frazier. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Freedom of religion is central to our national identity as Americans and a core objective of U.S. foreign policy. The right to believe in a religious creed or not, without fear of government interference, is essential to human dignity, robust civil society, and sustainable democracy. To promote these principles, every year our government compiles a report on the status of religious liberty around the world. It documents the actions of both governments that repress spiritual expression by their citizens and those that respect it. In its most recent findings, the U.S. State Department found that religious intolerance is on the rise in many nations, with interreligious and sectarian violence displacing millions of people and devastating communities. Government officials worldwide often act with impunity while violating the religious rights of their countrymen. Religious freedom is also impinged by the introduction of new restrictions, such as laws against perceived blasphemy and apostasy against mainstream faith. As in previous years, the government of Eritrea's record on religious freedom remains extremely poor, and the U.S. government has redesignated Eritrea as a country of particular concern because of severe violations of religious liberty there. Authorities continued to detain members of unregistered religious groups. That has been fueled by an increase in arrests of persons who refused to participate in the new citizen militia program, as well as arrests of those who refused to participate in the country's national service program on religious grounds. Other individuals have been harassed and detained for exercising their right to religious freedom, and there have been reports of forced recantations while imprisoned. Released prisoners report harsh detention and life-threatening conditions, including solitary confinement. Three persons detained for religious objections to military service reportedly died in custody during 2013. Religious freedom is a universal value. The freedom to profess and practice one's faith, to believe or not believe, or to change one's beliefs, is a birthright of every human being. Our nation will continue to shine a spotlight on violations of religious freedom in Eritrea and around the world, and will continue to promote this universal right as a moral and strategic imperative.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.